That's Debatable is sponsored by MB&G. MB&G are specialists in the esoteric world of vehicle and furniture warranty insurance, delivering quite marvellous customer service, prompt claims payment, and a highly developed understanding of how to deliver these products in a way that is both compliant with the regulations and attractive to customers. To find out more, call Paul Smith, the Managing Director, on 07887 501 441. That's 07887 501 441. Hello and welcome to That's Debatable, the weekly news podcast of the Free Speech Union. Well, Ben, I have a bone to pick with you this morning. You have me now addicted to another podcast, not related to free speech, but related to history. I've just finished, I think it's episode 8 or episode 9 even, of their Aztec. There's an Aztec series that The Rest is History did about 6 months ago. And I followed the story of Cortez all the way through to the final total massacre of all the Aztecs and the destruction of the Aztec Empire. And I have to say, I've got a bone to pick with you because you've addicted me or got me hooked on that particular podcast.
One of the things about that podcast, Tom, and the whole kind of history podcast ecosystem, and I think actually probably Tom Holland and Dominic Sandbrink must have discussed this at one point, but that whole ecosystem, I think, is basically killing off history degrees at university, which is a history graduate I've sort of mourn over. Given the choice between going and doing another degree and keeping up an active interest in history via reading and podcasts and going to museums and whatever, and avoiding the kind of gender, sex, race stuff that will be pumped at you in every module, no matter what your specialism now in most universities. That's certainly how it feels. Why would you go and study a history degree now? Which I really hate to say, I loved it, but I've started mine 15 years ago, so it may as well have been ancient history given how quickly things have changed. So I love that podcast, as indeed I think hundreds of thousands, millions of people do.
I love the way they ended the podcast, really talking about the fact it's a rollicking story, and I think it was Dominic Sandbrook who's just done a children's book on that story, that huge piece of history when the Spanish meet the Mexicans. And at the end, they really talk about, well, what questions does this raise about how we think about history and about whether we think, okay, are we able just to tell the fun story, or do we have to dwell on the sort of moral gray areas of the history? And of course, the answer is it's a bit of both. We do love our stories. And I really enjoyed the sort of last 15 minutes of the whole series when they talk about what good history is and how to relay history and make it engaging. But yeah, I'm addicted, Ben. So we won't be turning That's Debatable into a history podcast, but there's a risk of it anyway.
Well, I think if going back through some of our earlier episodes, I think there are some digressions in which we have attempted to do that, Tom.
We've certainly mentioned the Romans.
Yes. Yeah, okay, reset the counter.
But we should launch into our free speech podcast today. And then, and obviously, welcome to all our listeners again, as usual, and welcome to our new listeners. It's great to have everyone back with us. But we thought we'd kick off this week with a piece in The Spectator, actually, that our boss, Toby Young, wrote. And I think we both Ben and I stumbled upon this, obviously, because we keep track of what our boss is writing just to make sure that
we didn't stumble across it. We read it religiously every week.
We read it religiously every week. The No Sacred Cows section of The Spectator. But I think what struck me on this article that Toby wrote is he clearly starts with Humza Yousaf's hate crime act that we've discussed in multiple episodes before today, but then goes on in the article to survey the rest of the world. And as you go over the rest of the world, you realize just how much really worrying and chilling speech acts are in the in in the oven, really. So, I mean, just to list them briefly, you've got the new Irish Taoiseach, Simon Harris. He's absolutely determined to railroad through what they have in Ireland, which is the Criminal Justice Incitement to Violence or Hatred and Hate Offences Bill. We've got Donald Tusk in Poland. He wants to introduce a new law that would make it a criminal offence to defame a member of the LGBT community. We've got Justin Trudeau pressing ahead with an online harms bill that makes, well, as Toby says, it makes our own UK Online Safety Act seem like the First Amendment, which is very much what it's not. But I think what really is, of all of those, perhaps it's the Canadian one that is most shocking, because it will expand the definition of discrimination to include online speech likely to foment detestation or vilification of an individual or group. And, you know, it really does seem to expand the definition as well, not only to things that people have said, but to things that people might say in the future. So there's one point later in the article, Toby says, it isn't just stuff you've posted after the new law that comes into force. You can get in trouble for anything you've posted ever dating back to the dawn of the internet. And it also goes into more dystopian territory. Again, this is Canada.
Can I just butt in just on that one point, Tom, about this point about stuff you've posted in the past? I mean, that probably is basically the only virtue of the situation in Scotland. We had lots of people contacting us saying, you know, I said this in 2018, or indeed people complaining about Hamza Yousaf's speech 4 years ago, almost called him Hamza Useless then, which would have been an extremely apt Freudian slip. But and then the police response is, well, no, that predates the act, and so it isn't applicable. But I mean, that's astonishing, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, it's astonishing that it goes back, but it then is even worse. So if the courts believe you are likely to commit in the future a hate crime or disseminate hate propaganda, not defined, you can be placed under house arrest and your ability to communicate with others becomes restricted, i.e. a court can force you to wear an ankle bracelet, prevent you from using any of your communication devices, and then instruct you not to leave the house. And Toby references, we've talked about it before, actually, Ben, Minority Report. And I think I mentioned that I didn't understand the film the first time I watched it, probably because it was really long. And I fell asleep in the last 45 minutes where it all comes together and is supposed to make sense.
Explain it.
That would explain it. But, you know, even Philip K. Dick, who wrote Minority Report, they're only in that idea, in that dystopian novel, the police only arrest people they think are about to commit serious crimes, and only after they've been identified by what's in Minority Report called a precog, who literally sees the future. Well, it's not that good in Trudeau's act. It's 100 times worse, because there is no one here who can see the future. It's people who may say things in the future that are hateful just on a suspicion. So it's even worse than Minority Report, Ben.
But it is, you could say, better than the Metropolitan Police, who will arrest you if you're Jewish in anticipation of other people committing crimes.
Yes, that's very hot news at the moment, isn't it? And that actually, I think, was it the leader of the campaign against anti-Semitism was stopped and threatened with arrest for exactly that. And of course, that particular case has then rolled on, because the first apology kind of made it even worse by going back to this obviously Jewish description of that leader of the campaign against anti-Semitism. That is going to roll on, I think, Ben, isn't it? But yeah, I mean, we've been speaking about the dual policing in London for at least 6 months now. But I think what terrifies me in Toby's article is just we talk about oven-ready hate crime acts that are all over the world. Well, look at this list and how utterly hideous they are. It's really worrying. I mean, I we'd like to think we might be able to leave Britain if it gets that bad and go somewhere else. I don't think there are going to be many places left by the end of this, Ben.
We were talking, I think, a fortnight ago, Tom, weren't we, in a previous episode, about what the reaction would be in, well, from a Labour government to the debacle of the Scottish Hate Crime Act, and whether it would mean that, having seen this happen, this abject disaster unfolding since the 1st of April, I mean, it's incredible, it's not even been a full month yet, that a future Labour government would look at this and think, we just want no part of this whatsoever, and that it would significantly slow down the impetus for more legislation in this area from a Labour government. And, you know, actually, there is an argument for that. But what his article sets out, I think, is something else we've talked about previously, which is this sort of arms race between different Western liberal democracies to try and find the most censorious pieces of legislation, the most censorious approaches to quote unquote tackling hate crime that they can. And, you know, what one dreads a body more competent than the current Scottish government with legislation like this, because I mean, what the Scottish government have done, I think, because it's been so patently disastrous, and because the police have applied this new law in such an unequal way, and we've spoken about this, of course, before as well, it has meant, I think, that actually people are not yet feeling the full force of it, because the politics of this are now so toxic for the police if they go around and actually start arresting people after these complaints. So we can be grateful in a perverse sense for how disastrous the rollout has been, because it has meant that the full application of the law, I think, has been slowed down and muddied. So the idea of a more competent set of people enforcing a piece of legislation like this and doing it in a systematic way chills the blood somewhat.
I'm particularly chilled in that list that Toby sets out in the article. Yes, there's a focus on Canada and on the dystopian nature of the proposed Canadian Act. I'm actually particularly chilled by Poland, because I think we've talked about the Anglosphere, and we understand that the Anglosphere seems to be going down this rather strange road, and even Australia. Obviously, America's a bit different because it's got the First Amendment, although it still doesn't stop it seeming to go very crazy. But Eastern Europe, I've always felt, might be a little bit of a lifeboat for us all, because Eastern Europe is that much closer to real totalitarianism and living memory of real totalitarianism in the Soviet Union. And yet Poland is now going down this route. Obviously being dragged down that route via Donald Tusk. But, you know, I think they're all pretty terrifying. And it's worth noting as well that at the end of the article, the last paragraph, Toby says that I think it's time to set up a Canadian free speech union. And so if there are any listeners who'd like to help with the establishment of a Canadian free speech union, Toby's given an email address, which is TobyYoung, all one word, at freespeechunion.org. That's TobyYoung at freespeechunion.org. But it's a fairly dismal state of affairs. But hopefully there's something very practical and positive that we can do, which is to replicate some of what we've done here in the UK, the fight that we're fighting, over in Canada. So we could end on a good note, I think, on that
note. Absolutely. And there's so much demand for it. I suspect Toby will be inundated with volunteers and expressions of interest in that, given Canada and its state in the last five or 10 years. Great. All right. Now, Tom, what's next?
So next up, I briefly touched on this last week, or I think I threatened you Ben, with lots of numbers and lots of statistics and lots of adding up and subtracting to get you very excited about today. But we do have now the latest cut of the data from our case management system. And so I thought it might be worth just bringing to the attention of our listeners the headlines from that. And the first thing I would say, it's been our busiest quarter ever, Ben, which I think you've lived through and you would testify to, that the first quarter of 2024 in terms of the number of free speech cases has been crazy.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, obviously, Tom, you collect empirical data. So Tom, one of his jobs at the FSU basically is building up this gigantic database of cancel culture and who's been cancelled and why and what the penalty is and what they've said and who they work for and who the worst cancels are. So we'll get into all that in a moment. But one less empirical measure would be measuring the bags under my eyes and my receding hairline for the number of requests for help we get, which has been staggering. So we've had a job advert which has just closed for a new case officer. So we'll be expanding the team, which is great. But yeah, it's been extraordinarily busy. And Tom, I can see you're itching to get into the figures, so I will stop talking for a little bit and you can reveal these stats, which I think will probably astonish people, to be honest. Go for it.
Yeah, well, we're now over 2,500 free speech cases, and that includes some notifications where we often, what we do with notifications is we will push people towards our frequently asked questions or our briefing notes to help people understand how to navigate through a very specific situation, because we see so many versions of the same kind of thing crossing our desks. So that's 2,500 cases since we were set up in February 2020. And one of the things that always makes me laugh about that is sometimes I speak to my friends about, oh, how many cases do you look at the Free Speech Union? What is it, 10, 12, 15? People think it might be a sort of single digit number of cases that we've dealt with because they get this sense that cancel culture is a small thing and it's under control and maybe it hits the headlines every now and then, but it's over 2,500 cases. And of course, that's from amongst the people who know about us, who find us, who come to us. We still get people knocking on the door saying that they wish they'd heard of us earlier. They wish they knew we were around. But we're getting the word out there.
There was a case just to mention very quick that I saw in the Telegraph this morning, which was at Exeter University, of a student who had been put on some kind of behavioural policy back in 2018 because he'd criticised veganism in some way in his own room. So he'd been in his student bedroom in halls of residence. And criticise veganism, and the person, his flatmate, complained about this, and the university put him on this sort of behavioural policy, as it's been reported in the Telegraph and in the Mail on Sunday as well. So it's astonishing, as you say, Tom, we do get these cases of people who will come to us and say, well, you know, this happened to me 2 or 3, 4 or 5 years ago, before the FSU existed, in fact. There is an element to which this is the tip of the iceberg, isn't there?
Really, really is. And we I think we're always trying, when we're telling the story of the Free Speech Union, we're always trying to flip between the empirical stats, which are really important for communicating the size of the problem, and then the stories that really capture the imagination of readers and members. And we're trying to work out that balance between the two, because stats become quite dull and ultimately quite meaningless. But you bring them alive with a story like the one you've just said, and actually, oh, that's just one case, and it involved that crazy incident. You know, I mean, that's where we get the power of the two things coming together. But I mean, in terms of Q1, so we were over 250 new cases just in Q1 2024, 14 notifications relating directly to the Scotland Hate Crime Act. That was pretty much all in the run up to the 1st of April. And those notifications were all sorts of different things. People sort of just coming in and saying, help, what's going to get me in trouble? And again, we point people towards the FAQs. Fortunately, I think as most people are aware, we haven't had too many incidents of actually the police coming in. You know, after J.K. Rowling set herself up as a human shield in relation to the transgender issue. We haven't had too many people actually sort of dragged to the police station as yet.
My gut feeling is it's going to be a few months and they're thinking, okay, let's just let it all go quiet. And then they'll find some really egregious example to say, look, see, we told you there's so much hate and something must be done.
Yeah, I know. I think that's probably right. But our success rate stays steady this quarter at 74%. And I think we can reasonably kind of round that up to nearly three quarters of our cases, or three quarters of our cases, essentially, we win. And a couple of other things I'd point out is, first of all, the relentless growth in the proportion of cases that relate to gender, normally transgender, within that. And it's actually gone up. It was at 40% in 2023. It's gone up to 44% in Q1 2024. And this is despite wins. This is despite all of the progress we've actually made on the free speech side of this debate. It's still going up. And we're going to watch it really closely as 2024 proceeds. But 44% of our free speech cases relate to the transgender issue. Two other things I'll point out before our listeners will be thoroughly bored by too many numbers and stats. The first is I perceive a worrying growth in the proportion of our cases that relate to state intervention in some way. That's grown already. So in 2023, state interventions, that would be police knocking on the door, arrests, NCHIs, that category of case, was about 10% of our cases in 2023. Well, for quarter one so far, it's 15%. Which is obviously not an insubstantial increase. And within that, we know things like the NCHI that we've been helping Murdo Fraser with. We've got a few instances of people coming to us about the Hate Crime Act in Scotland. So I think there are some well-understood reasons for it, but still a big increase in state intervention in our data.
It's quite retro, isn't it, Tom? I've often thought that if we were speaking to a kind of human rights, civil liberties, civil rights campaigner from the 60s, say, and we said to them, to flip around what you've just said, if we said to them that, you know, this is what the Free Speech Union does, we exist to protect people's right to freedom of speech, freedom of expression, and about 10% of our work involves the state restricting people's freedom of speech, I think they'd find that really incomprehensible, that it was only 10%. The threat to freedom comes at least as much, or more than in our casework, from the private sector. And yet now, as in Toby's article, as in the Scottish government's latest shenanigans, we are seeing these kind of more traditional threats to freedom of speech, albeit now with the power and force of social media exposing many more people to censure from the state in a way that, you know, in the 1960s and 70s, if you'd written a particularly controversial play or a novel, you'd have fallen foul, but you know, people in the pub, by and large, obviously would not have done in any way at any time. So it's interesting, and of course to be much regretted, that we are seeing this more kind of traditional censorship in this, albeit new form.
It is, and it is something, of course, that I feel that the Free Speech Union, we very much shone a light on the, I mean, the big topic of our first 4 years with relation in relation to the state has been NCHI, non-crime hate instance, starting with the Harry Miller case, which, of course, was one of our very first big cases. And it just kind of brushed out, or not brushed out, what's the phrase, when you rush things out from undercover. Anyhow, it revealed the extent to which this very, very insidious state mechanism, the NCHI, had already embedded itself. And we've spoken before, we worry that if and when a Labour government comes in, they're intending to sort of bring the NCHI reality back into the fore in ways that we'd hoped we'd batted it away. So that is obviously something we're going to, this is still under a Tory government, it's gone from 10% to 15%, so we're going to watch this very carefully. But the last stat, Ben, that I was going to mention, of course, is And I don't know whether I should ask you this footballing question, because I had in the data, I had Premier League as part of the Football Association. And I don't know if that's correct, because the Premier League is obviously our top football clubs. I don't know if they then kind of report up into the FA. You may know that, Ben, you being the footballer that you are.
Yeah. On top of the detail there, Tom, completely.
Yeah, I don't worry. I won't put you on the spot on that. But anyway, that's how I put the data together. And so for obvious reasons, we had the case of Lindsay Smith, and we had an episode entitled The Stadium Stasi earlier in the first quarter of 2024. And that case, we put a call out to hear from people who might want to check whether they've got an NCHI, who might have heard of similar situations from the Lindsay Smith case. And obviously, when we put that call out, people have come back to us. And so the FA, the Football Association, which was already in our top 10 of sort of non-police forces, non-government departments list, has jumped right up that list in the first quarter of 2024 because of the case of Lindsay Smith. So, you know, and I could mention that obviously Police Scotland's gone right to the top of the list, and that the Scottish government itself has gone right to the top of the list. This is, none of that is surprising. But, you know, it's nice to see when we cut the data, it's nice to see that the experience you've had, Ben, with your team of managing the issues of the quarter. Another one I could mention is the CCP. Obviously, given the case of Michelle Shipworth, it's not that she was opposed to the CCP, but we've actually had people come to us and raise concerns about the CCP and the way that it might be affecting them. And so the Chinese Communist Party has actually gone up the rankings as well as the other party in some of our free speech cases. So everything's gone in the direction we would have expected to. But a couple of interesting trends, I think, that have come out over this first quarter of 2024 as well. But I feel I've bored our listeners, Ben. I feel I've bored our listeners with lots of stats and figures. And
they're both still listening.
There's one. The other one's gone to put a cup of tea on. Tell me when Ben's talking again, you know. But why don't we go to you? You sent me over the weekend a really interesting article. I think it was in The Critic. Do you want to talk about that article,
Ben? Let's do that. So this was an article by Ben Cobley in The Critic. And he wrote a book that came out, I can't remember what year it was off the top of my head. It was quite some time ago. I feel like it was sort of 2017, 2018, something like that. And it was called The Tribe, The Liberal Left and the System of Diversity. And I think there's an extent to which it was quite ahead of its time in setting out some of the arguments now with which people are all pretty familiar listening to this podcast and engaging with these kinds of issues in the way that we all do. He wrote in this article about what he has called this kind of existential defeat. And I'll paraphrase, a process by which a way of living life, in this case, a quintessentially English way of living life, becomes impossible because of all sorts of things, from decline of traditional communities and work moving online and the system of diversity, equality, inclusion, etc. The problematizing of all British history before Empire Windrush and so on. And I suppose really I just like to encourage people to go and read it. I thought it was really interesting. And one of the veins that runs throughout the article is, of course, our preoccupation, which is the decline of freedom of speech and the way in which, because freedom of speech has been allowed to decline and to become seen as problematic in the views of so many of the new elite. We've got into this awful position where institutions and politics and so much of the media and so on are completely unresponsive to the views, the sentiments, the demands of a majority of the population, which are, by the way, completely reasonable demands and expectations. So I thought it was really interesting. And he quotes John Gray, not known as a great optimist, saying that what might be called liberal civilization, liberal with a small L, I think is gone, it's over, and it can't be brought back, which is a somewhat pessimistic note. But
somewhat.
I was
somewhat.
but if I could talk just very briefly, without turning this into a history podcast, about something I was listening to over the weekend. I was listening to an episode of the BBC's In Our Time on Julian the Apostate, who was a Roman emperor for, I think, less than 2 years. And he tried to reverse the Christianization of the Roman Empire, and it was a completely doomed effort. And so lots of kind of enlightenment, kind of 18th, 19th century thinkers, Edward Gibbon and so on, absolutely love him and see him as this kind of paragon of reason and logic and philosophy against the irrationality of the church. But what I quite like about him is the way in which he makes this kind of completely doomed attempt against the spirit of the time in which he lives to try and restore another way of living. And there's something I find very admirable about that. And I think I said to you, Tom, over the weekend, didn't I, that it sometimes feels like we're engaged in a similar effort against the spirit of our time, or at least against the spirit of those who are influential and powerful and whose voices are most easily heard. So I'm not quite ready to give up. That's what I'm saying.
And you're saying we're most like Julian. Is that right?
Yes.
You're saying that we are fighting the same rearguard action against a tide that is going. Then I worry that we're like King Canute. If the tide is relentless, then it's right. It is a very bleak article. In fact, when you sent it to me, Ben, I was surprised how bleak it was, and it had obviously piqued your interest. I mean, there are a couple of things that are quoted in the article. Our political parties are like dumb and dumber. Having a decent sized home in a decent neighborhood is a distant dream now for many. Vital institutions like the police seem to have become singularly incompetent as they embrace the same identity politics as everyone else. And I think going back to your analogy of where we are, you know, the best we can hope for is enclaves or enclaves within which we still live the old culture that many of us are missing and many of us are pining for. You know, I think there is a real nostalgia to the article about something that we have very, very recently lost and that most of us remember. It's very much in living memory.
Yes.
But it's been very recently lost. The reason I say it's particularly bleak is to go back to your point about John Gray. No, it's gone and it's not coming back. That makes it very bleak.
It does, and it's worth reading. But I do have to say, I think as an assessment of where things are now, it's spot on. And I think the understanding of how we've got there and so on, I completely agree with and accept. But I take it as a challenge rather than a funeral oration for the West. And if I can mention the Romans one final time this episode.
It won't be a final time, Ben. It will certainly not be a final time.
This episode. if you Google a map of the Roman Empire in 250 AD, it's cut into three pieces. It's completely trashed. There's no hope of it ever being rebuilt. It has three different emperors. It's broken into three different states who each have their own Senate, who have been fighting civil wars and will be fighting civil wars for the best part of a century. And yet, thanks to the efforts of a relatively small number of very impressive people, the situation is completely turned around. So there are many lessons from history, including from English history, of situations that look utterly hopeless, which can be transformed through the efforts of a small number of highly motivated people. And I think if that is not a better description of the members of the Free Speech Union, I don't know what is.
I agree with that. And it's not just Constantine the Great, is it? It's Ben. I mean, obviously, he's one of the key names who turns it around and brings the empire back from the brink. But it's more than just him.
Yeah, it's My favourite is Aurelian, who I think was emperor for 5 years, and he won the title Restitutor Orbis, Restorer of the World. So let's each try and do that for our own little bit of the world, I think, and we'll make some progress.
I do like the fact, I think you've snatched optimism from the jaws of pessimism there. So I'd certainly think we'll leave in the show notes, we will leave a link to that critic article. But I think we're probably coming up to the end of today's episode. I thought it would be worth very briefly mentioning a great article that hit the Telegraph over the weekend from Raquel Rosario Sanchez. And she has written this piece in the Telegraph, and it references our EDI tax report that we've spoke about a couple of episodes again. It's got a bit more traction, actually. I think on the Daily Skeptic, it's got some traction, which is great. And it's obviously had some traction with this piece in the Telegraph. But what's really interesting, so Raquel Rosario Sanchez is actually obviously she's a woman, but she's also an immigrant, and she was working as a frontline worker supporting women recovering from crack cocaine and heroin addiction. So she was working in, you know, really tough circumstances, doing really important work. But what happened is she got invited to join the EDI group, and of course she said it was a moment of not despair, but real gloom when she was invited to that. She feared that it would be the sort of thing that our EDI tax report showed up, and that it would be kind of really, really in a very strange blind spot way, totally missing the point of looking after these women who are in desperate need of support, who are at their lowest ebb, and instead saying, oh, we all need to declare our pronouns, or we all need to do this and we all need to do that. And she said it was absolutely horrible and Stasi-like. And of course, it really draws out one of the points we made in that piece of research we did, that it's those who, for whom it is supposed to help, that it most alienates. And I think, again, we'll leave a link to that article. It's well worth reading, as again a really good example, I think, of what our survey drew out, and what we wrote about in that briefing paper. But I think, Ben, that's probably most of what we wanted to talk about today, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, if we did a sort of comprehensive review of all the free speech news of the preceding week, we'd be going for hours, wouldn't we? So we try and give you as crisp a summary as possible, which I hope we have succeeded in doing today.
Yes, normally what happens is we record now. We're recording on Monday, just about to turn afternoon. And then all the free speech news comes out in Monday afternoon. We say, oh, we missed that. We should have spoken with our listeners about that. But we'll always play catch up, I suppose. And we'll always try and make sure we're as cutting edge as we possibly can. But thank you to everyone for listening. And we do wish everyone a fantastic week. So bye-bye for now.
Goodbye.